Ennio Morricone, the famed composer of some of the most notable film scores of the 20th and 21st centuries, has died at the age of 91. The Italian, who left a self-written obituary, leaves a vast back catalog of movie work from mafia flicks to spaghetti westerns. England has reopened its hospitality industry after months of lockdown. We look at how the sector coped with a new set of rules in the first weekend and discuss what the future of dining looks like. And we'll be casting our eye over a new book that has been more than 7 years in the making. We'll discuss the impact of Mark Gevisser's Pink Line, Journeys Across the World's Queer Frontiers. Our editors delve into those topics coming up on today's Late Edition. Hello and welcome to the Late Edition. I'm Daniel Bache in London. We hope it's been a happy start to the week for you, our listeners around the world. I'm joined today on the program, also here in the UK capital, by Monocle editor Andrew Tuck and Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, we're going to talk about food and drink just a little bit later in the show. But first of all, Andrew, I feel like I get a look into your life a little bit with the Monocle Weekend Edition columns, but I never actually hear about your weekend. So how was it? Did you get out?
Well, that's because it's not very exciting. Well, two things. Did go to a restaurant. One, tick. Went on Saturday night, almost by accident. Actually, I went to get takeaway from somewhere. I saw it at a table and seized it, which is a kind of okay experience. People wearing like face shields, like welders in a steel plant or something. And you have to order off a QR code, which I hate QR codes at the best of times. But the food was good, and it was nice to be supporting a very, very local business only a street away from my home. So that was good. But then the sadness of it was that we were taking two friends out for dinner who have decided that the company they run will not be able to get going again in 2020. It will be 2021 before they return to full steam. So they're getting in their car tomorrow and heading off to Europe for 3 months to sit it out, to be honest. So while some businesses were getting up and running at the weekend, other people were still in a very tricky position.
And Fernando, looking at the headlines, I just saw scenes in Soho. I'm not sure what that means in the way kids speak today, but I think it means a lot of people were out. How was it in your end of town?
Listen, it was very busy, and it did became the story of the weekend. I have to be honest, I feel very conflicted about this, Daniel, because I do miss kind of this excitement of Soho. And actually, in the afternoon, there was moments where Sarah, you know what, it's quite nice. There was some chairs outside, a lot of restaurants, they're changing the rules a little bit. A lot of areas in Soho are becoming pedestrianized. But yes, I mean, there was certainly a little bit of chaos in the evening. I wasn't there. I was very happily at home watching a couple of films as well. So yeah, it's conflicting. It's things are reopening. And of course, we all wanted this to be perhaps a little bit less people actually in the streets, not as much as we saw it on Saturday. But there is a good side. I think, the business in Soho are happy to finally have some customers back as well.
We'll be digging a little bit deeper into the hospitality sector coming up a little bit later in the show. But first, some sad news from the world of cinema. Ennio Morricone, a legend of Italian and global cinema, has died at the age of 91. And Italian radio stations have been playing his songs throughout the day. In his honor, and why not, let us play a clip from 1988's Cinema Paradiso. Morricone was behind some of modern cinema's most memorable film music, including Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America and Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. The latter did win him an Oscar. Let's listen to biographer Alessandro De Rosa speaking on The Briefing a little bit earlier.
He was really emotional and really a person that could understand not only the characters of the movie, but also the director, for example, in this psychology. He was really smart and very sensitive. And so from this, when you can listen to someone and really understand the other person, you can give him what is good for him and also for the result, for example, with the movie. Because when you write music by yourself, it's okay. But if you write for the movie, you have always to be in dialogue with the director and with the other people, no, that are explaining you also what to do in a certain way.
Alessandro De Rosa speaking on today's edition of The Briefing. Andrew, Morricone apparently wrote his own obituary. I've read as well. He didn't bother to really learn English. He let the music speak for him. A very passionate creator. He sounds like a real character. What do you think?
So many people wanted to work with him. And when you look back at what he produced, my God, you know, some years he was 14, 15, 16 film scores coming from one man, which is extraordinary. And when you look at his history and the number of people he worked with and the live music he did and all of the things that he was involved with, it's just such an incredible legacy. So I don't blame him for wanting to have a bash at his own obituary first. He probably thinks that people would have missed out on some of the bits that he thought were most important. But an extraordinary man and somebody who could tug at the heartstrings. Although it's a shame that everyone's reduced him a little bit to being the spaghetti Western musician today, but just a great, great, solid career. But I've got a feeling that Mr. Fernando Augusto Pacheco may know even more than any of us about him.
Well, and if I may say, you're right, Andrew. I mean, it was not just spaghetti Westerns. In fact, my favorite track of Morricone is a song called Dance On, and it was from an Italian drummer from the late 70s called Stay As You Are with Marcello Mastroianni. I mean, it was basically Morricone going disco, and it was very much a loss for the world of cinema. I was very touched in our morning meeting today. Our colleague Carlotta Rebello, she's a big fan. She was almost teary in the meeting. I think, you know, I never seen Carlotta like this. So it's very much a loss to the world of cinema and music.
Andrew, you mentioned heartstrings, and earlier our Carlotta Rebello on The Briefing talked about how music makes you feel. You know, there is how we remember film for what it sounds like and those scores, but beyond that, the music plays such a huge part in how we feel and our emotional connection to that cinema.
There's a very interesting job for anybody who's writing a film score, because the director certainly doesn't want you to turn it always into a musical. They don't want you to own the film and to overwhelm the film with your music. But what's interesting is, you know, that people like Quentin Tarantino, even in recent years, saw in Morricone someone they could trust to bring their film to life, to be almost a character in the film with their music, but still somehow get this balance right between allowing the story to be told and it to be embellished and moved on and aided by the music. And here you have somebody who is, you know, in a way draws on the kind of the traditions of the great film scores. You know, when you think of the films from the 30s and 40s with, you know, proper pit orchestras, you know, huge sounds, violins, that's kind of what Morricone was still bringing to films today. There was a level of orchestration. It certainly wasn't the world of minimalist music. It was rich and it tugged on the violin strings and on heartstrings. He knew how to stir a feeling in people.
Fernando, there is that stirring feeling, but also, as I mentioned, how films make you feel. You know, there is the good, the bad, and the ugly, what Morricone is being remembered for perhaps most today. But beyond that, is there a certain film score that really does it for you, makes the hair stand up on your neck?
Well, first of all, I think cinema and music, they're so interconnected. I couldn't imagine a cinema without it, you know, in a way. And of course, since as a child, I grew up, you know, with films like E.T., for example, with the amazing composition of John Williams, or even La Dolce Vita by Nino Rota. I mean, those films are amazing, not just because of the script, but also because of the music. And I think, you know, if I have to choose a couple of favorites, I think E.T. for this memory I have as a child, and La Dolce Vita, which, I mean, the soundtrack, it was so influential to my life. I think that image of Italy, the glamour, which I still have it today in a way. So I think it's unfair if people say that cinema music, you know, is just whatever, it's just part of the film. I think it's essential. As Ennio Morricone proves it.
I think for me, definitely John Williams as well, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jurassic Park, and maybe even Saving Private Ryan. That really hit home for me. Now, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, England's hospitality sector received a much-needed boost at the weekend as many places reopened for business, but not quite as usual. Let's listen to a clip from Adam Hyman. He's the founder of Code Hospitality, a digital community for the restaurant industry. He joined us on The Globalist.
The less PPE, the less kind of strange elements in a restaurant, will make customers feel safer in a way. But I think let's not forget, no one's making anyone go out to have lunch or dinner. It's up to you if you want to go out to a restaurant. And I think we all want to go out and have a nice experience and a normal time. And I think the less of these kind of, you know, huge visors and face masks and kind of weird elements that we're not used to in a restaurant is for the better. And also, you've got to remember, restaurants, hotels, bars and pubs, they are experts at health and safety. This is what they've been doing for years and years and years. So you're in safe hands when you're going out for a meal.
Adam Hyman speaking there. Andrew, is that it? Does everyone just want to go out and have a good normal time after months of constraints?
Well, I don't know. I'm endlessly doing kind of my own survey of hospitality and retail as I cycle around the city. Or I just came into Midoriya House a short while ago. And on the way in, I deliberately cycled along routes where I'd see the most stores and restaurants to see what's open. And the incredible thing is that lots of pubs, for example, are still not open. They're still shuttered. They've decided that they're not in areas with large amounts of footfall. So actually, earlier this morning, I had to go over to Clerkenwell, a central neighbourhood of London, normally packed with office workers, lower on probably on residential customers. And many of the pubs there are just closed, and many of the cafes are closed, and many of the restaurants are closed. But then you get a strip where there's like enough of them together to draw in a crowd, where everybody has made an attempt to get something up and running. But I wouldn't say that anywhere seemed rammed. On Saturday, yes, at lunchtime, there was lots of the kind of cooler, successful pubs did seem to have crowds outside, and that dragged on into the evening. But I think lots of people had actually started drinking at like 1 o'clock, and they were done by nine. Certainly, I live two doors away from a public house, which actually shut its doors at 10 o'clock because it had run out of customers at night. So we saw these images from central London of huge crowds massing into Soho, where Fernando lived. But actually, it's much patchier when you go around the country. And it's only in England, of course. It's not a UK-wide thing, this at the moment. So I'm still nervous. And Adam, you know, is a great commentator on the industry. And it is funny when somebody has one of these kind of welder's masks on and they're taking your order. And then some of the things that are put in place to make you feel safe seem a bit stupid to me. So, for example, when the waiter comes to your table at the restaurant we're at, they were told that they weren't allowed to touch the plate to put it in front of you. So they asked you to take the plate off a tray and put it in front of you. But who put the plate on the tray in the kitchen? So someone must have touched it at the beginning, but then they can't touch it at the end. Now, I'm not worried about that at all. I would be much happier for somebody just to put the food down in front of me. As Adam says, you know, if everyone has cleaned their hands, if everybody is not kind of, you know, sat too close to each other, then you have to think, okay, these are some of the risks I will take to go back out in the world. So we'll see how it goes. And actually, I did see that some very, very nice restaurants were posting pictures at the weekend on social media, and it was clear that some of them had already ditched the face masks and the shield. So let's see what happens. But I think that a bit more common sense around it is what's needed. And let's make the most of the summer while you can sit outside when the weather's nice. I think lots of people are going to be doing that. And in the breeze, I think most people accept it's much, much harder to catch COVID-19 anyway.
Fernando, you talked about people being out on the streets in Soho. Of course, it's a big part of what cities need to do to get more people out enjoying themselves, provide more space that is outdoors where people feel safe. But what about this weekend? Did you get out in Soho? Are you looking forward to going out more this week? Are you happy to stay at home and cook?
No, certainly. In fact, actually, this weekend, even though I live in Soho, I decided to go for a walk. I went to London Bridge to Borough Market. I had some lovely Argentinian empanadas, and it felt very good. And you know, another thing I would like to say about the food and hospitality industry, I very much admire their creativity during this difficult period. For example, one of my favorite restaurants in London is Shu. They serve lovely Taiwanese food, and it's a very small place. So they are not reopening as a restaurant for now, because I think it is indeed a very small space. I think it would be a bit hard, especially if, you know, because of the distance rule. But they are transforming themselves into a new takeaway service. They changed their name to Call Susie. I mean, which there's lovely graphs and there's a different menu. And again, I love their food, so of course I'll be ordering from them. So I like that. You know, not all places can reopen, but I can see people are working hard, you know, to because it is a very difficult period for them. I think they've been hit by COVID-19 is one of the most affected industries. So I'm very happy to see people being creative like that. And I will be calling Susie maybe later this week.
Andrew, you mentioned a little bit earlier that a lot of businesses won't be able to open. Obviously, they're sitting and waiting, seeing what's going to happen in the weeks ahead. But what would it take for those business owners to want to open, to feel confident to open the doors again?
Well, the problem is until people are willing to go back to work, then it's just not going to happen. Because, you know, as I said, if you go to a neighborhood, many inner city places like where we are, they're dependent on office workers. And if the office workers are not going to be asked to come back to the office, you know, even in 2020 in many instances, then for those restaurants, I think it's the end of them. I don't think that many of them will open. Even Pret a Manger, a super successful chain here, has this morning announced 30 stores closing, 1,000 jobs gone. And I think that the whole of this hospitality sector will have an incredibly brutal shakeout until, you know, we find it in a world where people are going back to work. So it's just going to be tough. And the other thing that has to end is furlough, because furlough is amazing and it's been super successful at getting us through the virus. But in the end, many restaurants are saying, you know, why would I ask people to come back to work when the government will pay their salaries and I can keep one or two people in the restaurant doing a delivery service? Why would I bring back all those waiting staff and have to risk trying to make their salaries back? Let's just leave people on furlough to the very last minute. So I think once the furlough scheme ends, it will be desperate and tough and people will lose their jobs. But that will also force these establishments to decide, are they in it or are they out of it?
Fernando, I wonder if very quickly you could take us to your homeland in Brazil. What are the plans to reopen hospitality there?
Well, it's interesting you ask me this today because my hometown, São Paulo, bars and restaurants, they are allowed to open from today. I think Brazil, you know, we don't take decisions nationwide. I think it depends on the state. Rio de Janeiro, they opened this weekend, and it caused the same controversy as it happened, the crowds in Soho, in Leblon, in Rio, the first day that bars were crowded. You know, there are many videos on social media, and people are like, oh, look at that. Do we really want this while we're in the middle of the pandemic? So it's a very similar type of discussion that we had here, but we're certainly looking into reopening bars and restaurants in the city of São Paulo. But again, Brazil, every day the situation changes. Sometimes I think now there are other regions of the country that are more affected. And yes, it depends on which state do you live.
And finally today, let us finish the show with a look at a new book that took more than 7 years to finish. It's titled The Pink Line, Journeys Across the World's Queer Frontiers. We spoke to the book's South African author, Mark Gavisser, earlier today on Monocle 24. Let's have a listen.
That's precisely the concept of The Pink Line, the way a new global human rights frontier has been drawn by this explosive new conversation about sexual orientation and gender identity and who is deserving of rights, and what does a family mean, and what does a man mean, and what does a woman mean. All of these ideas have become activated in a kind of new geopolitics over the last decade or so. So just for example, in 2013, the same year that the United Kingdom legalized same-sex marriage, Nigeria promulgated legislation that was called the Anti-Same-Sex Marriage or the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act. Now, no one in Nigeria was even talking about same-sex marriage, but this was a way that Nigerians and other Africans could signal, if you like, their independence from the previous colonial master and make an argument against what they saw to be as a kind of neocolonialism, sort of forcing these ideas of homosexuality and transgenderism onto them. So they kind of weaponized the issue, almost as a form of backlash, partly for those bigger geopolitical reasons, but also because in many countries like Nigeria, like Uganda, like Russia, like Singapore, there was a population of people who had kind of downloaded these ideas of equality from the net, thanks to the digital revolution, thanks to the forces of globalization, and were demanding rights for the first time. So for the very first time in countries like Nigeria, there were Nigerians saying, we will not be discriminated against. We deserve dignity. We deserve freedom. So much of what you're describing is a backlash against people claiming those rights.
Mark Avisser, author of the new book, The Pink Line. Fernando, we think so many advances have been made in terms of LGBTQ rights, but this book seems to show us how polarized the world actually is, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very interesting book because it's true. I mean, many countries, there's so many, you know, there are more LGBT rights than ever. And it's true. It was a trend, you know, even countries that you wouldn't imagine that would approve gay marriage did so. But at the same time, what we're seeing in the last years, and that's what Mark is arguing, precisely because, you know, a lot of countries are seeing that those rights are happening. For example, he mentioned that for the first time, people in Nigeria or Russia, they started, you know, protesting. They said, you know what, I want my rights. But at the same time that this happened, governments in those countries, they start to weaponize gay rights, you know. And of course, sometimes they associate this with religion. And at the same time, so you see a lot of countries actually doing anti-LGBT kind of laws. We have a presidential election in Poland coming this weekend. And I think the favorite to win, he very much run on an anti-gay platform. Even countries that have, you know, for example, even in Brazil, where we have gay marriage, I mean, we have a president that did, you know, he won actually an election with a fake news saying that, you know, if the other candidate would win, they would start selling a gay kit in schools, which is clearly fake news. But the evangelical community believed in that. So it's interesting with progress. We're also seeing kind of a little bit of a backlash against this progress, which is quite interesting.
Thank you, Fernando. We will have to leave it there for today. That's it for the late edition. A big thank you to Andrew Tuck and to Fernando Augusto Pacheco here in London. Thanks as well to all our editors and studio managers, Louis Allen and Sam Impey, as well to producer Ed Stalker. I'm Daniel Bache here in London. Thank you so much for listening and goodbye.